joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Long-term health care insurance from the government, it's being considered in the Senate. It's already in the House version of health care overhaul legislation. The proposal is projected to be one of the deficit-lowering strategies, at least initially. But critics say it will end up in the red. Joining me to talk about a public long-term care insurance plan, Marilyn Werber, Serafini of the National Journal, James Furman of the National Council on Aging, joining us from a studio at WHYY in Philadelphia, Scott Harrington. He's professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. We do invite you to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Marilyn, let me start with you. Tell us where this long-term proposal now stands.
Well, the proposal had its first major test in Congress on December 4th, and it was a little touch and go there because there was one hurdle they had to get past, and that was there was some concern from both liberals and moderates on the Democratic side that perhaps some of the money that would be collected in premiums for this program could then be used for deficit reduction or for other government spending. Senate Majority Leader Reid quickly put in a firewall so that that money could only be used to pay out benefits. So they got over that first hurdle. But when they took the vote, they still had objections from Republicans. They wanted to kill the bill. There was an amendment to try and kill the bill, but that did not happen. However, 11 Democrats plus one independent, Joe Lieberman, voted against the CLASS Act. And I'm not sure that was expected. And, the program is still in there, but there are some concerns. And I think that that vote showed that they're not out of hot water yet.
Marilyn Werber, Serafini, she's healthcare and welfare correspondent for the National Journal. Jim Furman, why do you think that this would be such a benefit to so many people?
First of all, the American people have lousy choices now. If they need long-term care, either they have to become impoverished and go onto Medicaid, which usually means a nursing home, or they have to rely on their families, or they have to rely on mediocre private long-term care insurance policies. The CLASS Act will help millions of Americans to stay at home and in the community if they need long-term care. It's a great benefit. It's a cash benefit. It's $75 a day, which is enough to stay at home if you need it or to stay in use at adult daycare services if you want it. It is fiscally sound. It is won't cost the taxpayers a dime, it would be passing. The reason that 10 senators voted against it is because a few insurance companies are spending millions of dollars lobbying hard, spending misinformation to sway the votes.
Jim Furman, he's president and CEO of the National Council on Aging. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Scott Harrington, how do you see it? Does it make sense as a cost-saving benefit? Does it help the 10 million Americans who need long-term care insurance?
It may help people. However, it does constitute a new unfunded entitlement. It would reduce deficits in early years, but the CBO and others project that it would increase deficits ultimately by tens of billions of dollars. It also faces a problem in the design that it's very likely it would be unsustainable without significant taxpayer subsidies, regardless of the way the program is described initially. And the basic reason for that is it would provide this coverage on a guaranteed issue basis and would be very likely to primarily attract people that will need care, which would drive up the premium that would be needed for the program to be self-sustaining. And in turn, that'll make healthy people less likely to want to buy the coverage. So it is very likely it will increase deficits in the out years, and it will be subject to this disproportionate utilization by people that will need care, which will very likely make it unsustainable over the long run.
Scott Harrington, he's professor of healthcare management and insurance and risk management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I know many of you are concerned about this issue, and we do invite you to participate this morning. Marilyn Werber, how do you react to what you've just heard from Scott Harrington, that it becomes an unfunded entitlement, it has a design flaw, it's going to create huge deficits in the future?
Well, there's an important distinction that really needs to be made here, and that is that this is, Scott said, it is a self-sustaining program, and that is true. This is a government program. People have the ability to sign up for it. In fact, it's one of these types of things where your employer can sign you up, and it comes out of your payroll unless you opt out of it. So it is a government program. You are in unless you opt out of it. But now, he said that it is a self-sustaining program, and that's correct, which is really different than it being an entitlement program. This program is intended to be funded entirely from premiums. So when we're talking about it potentially reducing the budget deficit in the first 20 years, which are the projections from multiple sources, and then potentially increasing the budget deficit after that time, we're not really talking about decreasing and increasing the budget deficit, because it is funded solely by premiums. If there was a need, if the premiums were not enough, say 30 years out, to pay for the benefits, it would only increase the deficit if the government decided to step in and fund it.
Scott Harrington, do you want to respond?
I think, in a sense, that's correct, but there are two things that will happen. And one is, although I haven't studied the firewall provisions that Marilyn mentioned, in the short run, when we accumulate premiums under this program, it will reduce the unified budget deficit. But basically, one part of the government will be issuing IOUs to the new long-term care insurance program. And eventually, when premiums are insufficient to pay benefits, the money will have to come from somewhere, whether it be additional borrowing or reduced spending, because it's not as if this money will be invested to accumulate interest as it would in a private insurance plan. The other thing is whether this program will be sustainable without premium subsidies. And I alluded to this before. Organizations like the American Academy of Actuaries and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services have argued pretty strongly that the premium that would be necessary to make this self-sustaining will actually be fairly high, might be well over $100 a month. And at that level, most people or many people will not want to participate, and those that do participate will be those that are more likely to need care. As a result, you'll need yet an even higher premium. We don't know for sure what will happen, but you do have this possibility that even though the plan is for the program to be self-sustaining, you won't be able to charge a high enough premium without a subsidy to make the program viable over time, in which case it'll either shrivel on the vine or it would basically require a formal subsidy of some sort
right,
to make it viable over time.
James Fairman.
Let's get the facts about this bill. First of all, the law expressly prohibits the use of federal funds and taxpayers' funds for the bill. The Senate also, by unanimous House votes that this money would be set aside. So the belief that this is going to cost taxpayer dollars is unfounded and against the law. First of all, secondly, the bill requires from day one that this be actuarially sound. It has an enormous number of safeguards. It has to be sound for 75 years. There is no other provision in this bill, in the whole health care reform, that has these solvency requirements.
Jim, what about the fact, what about, as Scott Harrington points out, that the people who need it most are going to be the ones to sign up for it, and therefore it's going to cost more than it looks as though it would cost now?
All right, let's look at that. That's the key thing. The assumption by the actuary, and who's going to be on, was that 2% of people would take up this program. That's the number given to him by the insurance industry. This is an opt-out benefit. The closest thing to it is Medicare Part B, where people have to opt out. 4 or 5% opt out, 95% take it. The assumption driving this whole debate is that 98% of people will decide not to take this benefit. That's absurd. It's ludicrous. It's an assumption given by the insurance industry driving this debate, and it's ridiculous.
Marilyn.
Well, there is the estimate that only 2% of the eligible population would sign up for this. There are two other important estimates. There's a 2% estimate, a 4% estimate, and a 6% estimate. So you have three actuaries saying that it's going to be anywhere from 2 to 6% take up. And Scott mentioned that the premium could well be above $100 a month. Actually, it could be as high as $180 a month by some estimates.
Marilyn Werber Serafini, she's healthcare and welfare correspondent for the National Journal. We will be taking your calls. Stay with us. As we talk about long-term health care insurance, we're joined by phone from Baltimore by Richard Foster. He's chief actuary for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Good morning to you, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good morning to you, too.
Please explain the role of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Well, this agency administers the Medicare and Medicaid programs in the Office of the Actuary within CMS. We also estimate total health spending in the U.S. and also proposals to enact health care reform generally.
Now, what are your projections then? What do they indicate potential costs and projected revenues for this kind of long-term health care program?
For the specific class proposal in the Senate health care reform bill, we've estimated that through fiscal year 2019 that the premium revenues to the program would exceed the expenditures for benefits and administrative costs by about $38 billion total. But we've also estimated that the benefits would continue to climb, and in 2025 and later, there would be a an excess of benefits and administrative costs over the premium revenues.
So, Marilyn, hearing that from the actuary, how do you respond to that projection of costs?
Well, basically, you know, Rick Foster's estimates haven't been too far off. They've been a little harder than the Congressional Budget Office and some of the other sources, the American Academy of Actuaries. But I think what you have to think about is that this is a program that, because it is self-sustaining, there will have to be some reaction if there is not enough money, if there is not enough premium money to
right.
pay for the benefits.
Uh-huh.
So that what happens then is that you're either going to end up with higher premiums, and this is why we have such a range of
right,
premium estimates
from
100
to 180.
Exactly. So we could end up with higher premiums
right.
as a result, or we could end up with the program ending. We could end up at some point, and this is what some of the supporters of the program are saying, there's no harm in trying this program, because if we do end up in that situation where we run out of money, then you can either simply leave those who have signed up on the program, or you can and stop taking new enrollees, or simply end the program, no harm done.
Let me understand the particulars here. Is there an age limit at which one could enroll in this kind of program, Marilyn?
Well, I don't believe there's an age limit, but there are two requirements. Once you sign up for this program, before you can start drawing benefits, you have to pay premiums for 5 years.
Right.
And you also have to be employed a certain number of hours a week. So the idea behind those two proposals is that you don't want someone who has moderate to severe Alzheimer's all of a sudden signing up on day one and on day two drawing down benefits, because then you have not had that person paying premiums in, and then there's probably guaranteed failure. The question is whether or not those two requirements are enough to get people paying into the system sufficiently to get the money into the system that then needs to be paid out in benefits.
Jim Furman.
Well, first of all, this estimate by Mr. Frank is only one of several different estimates. The Congressional Budget Office has said this is fiscally sound for 75 years. But the most important point of this is the assumption that only 2% of people will take this benefit. All the evidence from other countries on an opt-out benefit is that probably more like 15 or 20% will take it. Premiums will be $100 or less. And to buy into this premise, the last thing I want to say about the actuary, this is a government actuary who refuses to release his assumptions and on how the premiums and take-up rates are. We asked for transparency on the assumptions behind this. So far, Mr. Frank has refused to make them public.
It's not Mr. Frank. It's Mr. Foster.
Mr. Foster, I apologize.
Okay,
thank
Richard
you.
Foster, what about that transparency issue?
Well, you know, sometimes it's best to count to 10 before you say something, so I'm counting to 10 right now. let me make two comments. First of all, we're independent, we're objective. We don't have a stake in whether this proposal is a good idea or a bad idea. What we're trying to do is provide objective technical information so the policymakers will be informed as they develop the policy. So, first of all, nobody has asked for the assumptions, but we put a lot of them into the memo, and we'd be happy to tell anybody the rest of the assumptions. So we haven't refused anybody. Second, in terms of, I believe Mr. Furman said that the 2% assumption was given to us by the insurance industry. That is just not the case. If you look at the experience with employers who offer as a fringe benefit this sort of long-term care coverage, on average about 4% of their employees take it up. We thought that in this particular circumstance, with the relatively minimal work requirements that are in place, that there would be a lot of adverse selection that would tend to raise the premium above normal levels, and as a result, that would chase away people in better health than average or even average health people, and that's how we came to the 2% take-up assumption.
Okay, let me follow that up, if I may, Mr. Foster, because It strikes me that if an individual were to go for long-term care through an employer, that employer's cost is going to be far greater than what might be offered in a public long-term care plan. And therefore, you would have a very small number of people opting in your 2% figure. For example, I looked into long-term care insurance and found out it would cost something like $900 a month through an employer. So the idea of creating a long-term government-sponsored program might be far more attractive to a far greater number of employees. What say you?
A couple of thoughts about that. First of all, suppose for the moment that we have a large group of people who are all of average health. They all have a similar and fairly low probability of actually qualifying for such benefits because of functional limitations. And then if you follow those people through time, and so over time some of them develop such limitations, in which case the benefits become payable. Now, if you look at the cost for, say, the government to run such a program versus the cost for the private sector to run such a program, they won't be wildly different. There would be some differences if the government program is very large and has an economy of scale on administrative costs, and there would be some difference between the government because it wouldn't have to have a positive profit margin. So there would be some relatively modest differences like that. Now, look at other issues, though, besides just the cost of a normal program for people in average health. In the private sector, if an employer is offering such coverage and his workers are actively at work, that's sort of a substitute for underwriting that might otherwise occur in like an individual policy in the private sector. For the class proposal, the proposal is it has a fairly minimal work requirement. You have to work for a certain number of years,
right,
and earn at least $1,000.
Right.
So it would be much easier to qualify to participate in the class program than it typically would in an employer plan. That leads to the adverse selection, and that can have a very powerful effect on the cost.
Marilyn, a powerful effect on the cost?
Well, you know, there really are a lot of questions here,
sure,
about whether it works and whether it doesn't work. But there are even those folks who want this program to succeed and want this program because they want to offer another option for long-term care services for people, are concerned about whether this works out economically and actuarially, meaning is it going to be around for people, and are the premiums going to be low enough that people will sign up for this? And the estimates really are, even though they vary somewhat, there's a lot of concern about how high the premiums would have to be to make this work, to make sure that we have a good pool of both of people signing up, so that you don't just have the folks who are you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's today, or maybe you were diagnosed with it 5 years ago, and all of a sudden you're able to come in and just kind of wait that 5 years and get the benefit.
James Furman.
Well, I want to say this one more time. Mr. Forrester assumed that the private take-up rate is 4%. For an expensive program. He's saying that's an opt-in program. He's assuming that an opt-out program, which will be less expensive, will have half the take-up rate. It's absurd. I challenge that assumption. There is no history in any opt-out program in this country or around the world that has less than at least a 10 or 15% take-up rate. Secondly, the provisions of this bill specifically instruct the secretary to make sure this is actuarially sound, to make adjustments in premiums, to make adjustments in eligibility, to make adjustments in benefits. This guarantees solvency. It's built into the system.
Marilyn.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out for comparison that, There is private long-term care insurance, of course, available today. There has not been a huge take-up rate for that. We have 10 million people in need of long-term care at this point, and 10% of people over the age of 50 currently have the private insurance. That's not a huge amount of people.
But can it be argued that the reason there has been so little take-up is how expensive those programs actually are?
That's very possible. And the question, one of the main questions that people are raising is, even if it is less expensive for a new government long-term care program, if we do end up having premiums that are $180 a month, is that affordable for everyone? Say you're 30 years old and you're paying $180 a month for insurance that you think in your head, I may never need this. I may never be disabled. I may never have a spinal cord injury that requires me to have long-term care. And that's the problem that we've had for a long time with the purchase of private long-term care insurance. People wonder whether they'll need it.
Marilyn Werber, Serafini, she's with the National Journal. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones. We'll take calls from our listeners. 800-433-8850. First to Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Marcus. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. One of the problems I see here is that we debate all these different issues about every different plan, and the bottom line is nobody looks at the most important part of the problem, and that's that the system is broken. It's corrupt. Everybody above the rank of nurse is making a killing and will never let this system change. They never let fees go down to where they are in the rest of the world. The rest of the world's systems work far better because they have reasonable fees and nobody's making a killing. No CEOs are making $900 million, just where the top 10 CEOs.
All right. I'm afraid you're fading out on us, Marcus. Scott Harrington, do you want to comment?
Yes. Couple quick comments. One would be that studies do indicate that in the United States, physicians get paid significantly more than they do in other countries. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One reason is that we spend less or subsidize less physician education than in other countries. Medical students typically will come out of medical school with $150,000 to $200,000 in debt. And in general, although it's hard to sometimes explain some physician salaries, it takes a substantial salary to attract people into the profession given the cost of going to school. So there is some truth to that our doctors get paid more, but I wouldn't characterize it the way the caller did, that it's basically some sort of rigged game.
Marilyn.
You know, it's also, there are huge disparities among what doctors get paid. You could have your neurosurgeon doing very well and your pediatrician just trying to scrape, just trying to get by. So, in fact, one of the things that that could result from healthcare reform is that just about everybody wants to bring down some physician
equalize,
bring up some physician fees so that some aren't starving and some aren't doing while others are, you know, have 10 vacation homes.
Here's an email from Norma who says, I'm anxious to hear the discussion today. What happens to those of us who've been paying premiums on long-term care insurance all these years? This is an opt-in program, is it not, James?
Yeah, well, so first of all, if you have policies, you'll be able to keep it as long as the companies are there. But let's look what's happened to the private long-term care insurance market. They've been beleaguered by poor investments, policyholders who are hanging longer. And what have they done? Genworth, the leader, the biggest, which is driving the opposition to class, raised its premiums 8 to 12% for 440,000 policyholders. Hancock raised its premiums by 25%, CNA by 50%, AIG by 70%, Travelers Life Insurance by 140%, and it got so bad that Conseco went into receivership for its plan. So it's very shaky to rely on private long-term care insurance alone. That's why we need a bigger risk pool, a government benefit, and something that people can can rely on.
Marilyn.
Yeah, you know, right now it's also important to remember that whether we have this new government program, the CLASS Act, whether we you could end up with some people in that program, you could end up with some people in private long-term care insurance. Currently, Medicaid, the health care program for the poor, pays for most long-term care. That also is not expected to change. Currently, Medicaid pays 40% of all long-term care costs. That added up to $178 billion in 2006.
And how solvent is that program?
Well, it's an entitlement. So it's not really an issue of solvency. It is Medicaid. No one wants to be on Medicaid. There are plenty of studies that show that if you end up in a nursing home and Medicaid is the primary financier, you don't get quite as good care.
Marilyn Werber, Serafini of the National Journal. More of your email, your phone calls, your tweets, and your messages from Facebook. When we come back, stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. And by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
He's the master of the legal thriller. He's also dabbled in nonfiction, now turns his attention to short stories. Best-selling author John Grisham on why he set his collection in a fictional Mississippi Delta town. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Let's go right back to the phones to Sue Ellen, who's in Reston, Virginia. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
I'm just completely befuddled with this discussion. I just don't understand why we would not want to begin to address, I think, one of the country's most critical, you know, problems or challenges, you know, the burden of long-term care, both the financial burden as well as the burden to families and friends. I started looking for long-term care insurance and product in my 40s, and it was way over the premium rates that you all are talking about. And quite frankly, it left me with only nursing home coverage, and I'm not interested in that. So it seems to me that at this time, why not try something where I can exercise my own personal responsibility to plan for the future. It's not going to cost my employer any contributions, and appears clearly not to cost taxpayers. And I would think it would save the federal government and the states in their Medicaid.
All right. Richard Foster, do you want to take that one?
I'll just make one comment on this, and then I'm afraid I'm going to have to go shortly.
That's fine.
For the CLASS proposal, as it's designed, it would be self-supporting on a long-term basis from the premiums and from interest paid on the investments in the class trust fund. That's assuming that the adverse selection doesn't cause the program to collapse. So the interest on the investments would be a payment from the federal government to help support this. So that's why you get a contribution to a budget deficit after the first so many years, even though the program, from a trust fund standpoint, is self-sustaining.
Richard Foster, Chief Actuary at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. One last question before you go, Richard. Will your information and how you came to your conclusions be open for the public to see?
Certainly. If anybody has any questions, they can address them to us. We'd be happy to answer them. When time permits, we have in the works a memorandum on methodology for all of our health reform estimates.
Is there a website?
It's not on the website yet, but...
And what would that website be?
It's www.cms.hhs.gov.
So it is a government-sponsored group, and you are working for the government, in fact.
Yes, I've been working for the government for, seems like, 37 years.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now,
Diane, could I comment on the last question, please?
Certainly, Scott. Go right ahead.
I think what we have to keep in perspective is we have an enormous projected deficit for Medicare, and even if that comes down as a result of a health reform bill, it's going to put tremendous stress on the federal budget 10, 20, 30 years from now. And the current economic situation and the current deficit spending related to the economy is much higher than historical norms, so that there might be a lot of good programs we can think about, but we have to be very careful about creating a new program that could put additional strain on federal budgets in the years ahead, because most economists think we run a significant risk if we increase borrowing further that we'll have a hard time selling our debt to other countries and the like. So I just would encourage the caller to keep everything in context. It might be that we could use a new program, but whether or not we can bear the risk and take that chance is another issue.
All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Dimitri. You're on the air.
I'm 88 years old, and I pay taxes all my life, and I'm absolutely incredulous about how long it takes the servants, Congress, to represent the people, when it was breathtaking how quickly the money was allocated to Wall Street. All my friends are in the 80s and 70s, but we're becoming we're developing adversarial attitudes towards our government because we can no longer use the term our government. It's their government.
It's very interesting, James Furman.
Well, that's a very important point because there's 78 million baby boomers who are experiencing what their parents have gone through, which is if they need long-term care, their choices are lousy. Insurance they can't afford or having to spend down and go on Medicaid. This is an opportunity for 78 million people to do what Mr. Foster said. Let's be clear, this is an actuarially sound program. What Mr. Harrington said was irrelevant to the fiscal soundness of class. This is not costing the taxpayers anything. They're enabling the people to pay them for what they need, care at home, if they need long-term care.
And joining us now is Sandy Prager. She is Kansas Insurance Commissioner. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
With or without a public plan, many, many people shy away from buying long-term care insurance. Why do you suppose that is?
We look at long-term care insurance, you know, it's a product that if we're thinking about buying it, it's something we know we're not going to use until far into the future, and we really don't know for sure what we're going to need. And there's so many options out there, it can be very confusing for folks. When I have friends ask me, what should I do about long-term care insurance? And I say, you know, preserve as much flexibility as possible so that you are not limited, as one of your callers just said, to receiving services in a nursing home. Some long-term care policies now allow for you to stay in your home to receive in-home services. They'll even pay for home modifications that might be needed, with grab bars in the bathroom and wheelchair ramps and the like. So buying something that preserves as much flexibility as possible, I think, helps people at least think about long-term care insurance. And I think another important point is that you shouldn't view long-term care insurance in the same way you view health insurance. Long-term care insurance is an asset protection policy. If you have assets that you want to protect, how many of those assets do you want to protect? How much do you want the long-term care insurance to pay for you, and what can you perhaps pay above and beyond that? So it's not for everyone, I think, and obviously we need to do more in our country to preserve the ability of our seniors to live their lives with dignity as they age through the rest of their lives.
Now, a question on that: if in fact the government did begin to offer a long-term care policy, do you think that more people might be interested in taking up that kind of insurance if they were offered private or government-sponsored?
I think it generates, just having it out there generates more discussion, and I think that's good. There is another program that is a partnership program between the private and the public sector. That's the Long-Term Care Partnership Program, which allows you to buy a limited benefit policy. Let's say it's a two-year benefit. You're going to use it when you begin to need long-term care services. The policy will pay benefits for 2 years. Policies that are limited like that are much more cost affordable. The partnership aspect of it then says, if you need long-term care services beyond that benefit period, you can become Medicaid eligible and preserve assets dollar for dollar what the policy paid for you. So you could, you know, essentially preserve up to a little more than $100,000. So it's another way of encouraging people to buy a more limited benefit, affordable policy, and preserve assets going forward if they need to access long-term care services beyond that benefit period.
I realize that you're in an official position as Kansas Insurance Commissioner. Would you personally be in favor of seeing a government-sponsored long-term health insurance program?
As long as it can be demonstrated that it's actuarially sound, so that we don't hold out a program that won't be there when people actually need it.
But you know, Sandy, the concern I have, I mean, we're hearing two views this morning. You heard from James Furman arguing it would be actuarially sound. It would not raise the deficit. You heard from Richard Foster arguing for a short term it would be sound, but then would balloon upward. Who are we to believe, and are senators simply going to argue against this kind of program? I think there's a lot of confusion here.
Well, you know, Diane, I would agree with you, and I don't know who to say we should believe either. I just think I'm a public official. I just need to make sure that when I put forth a program, that it can live up to its billing. And the concern is when the interest has to be paid back, does this in fact create a ballooning in the federal deficit? But the other side of that is that if we have more of our seniors needing Medicaid services, as you know, it's been mentioned that that's an entitlement program, that also adds to the cost of government programs. So the more we can do to encourage people to take responsibility for their long-term care, whether it's through a government program or a private program, I think the better off our families will be, because we know long-term care services can be very costly.
All right. If you would stay on the line, we'll take a call from Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Diane. The question that I had is that a lot of the discussion is concerning long-term care, which affects older Americans. And yet it seems like the discussion is being driven by another segment of the voting population. The older population tends to be the most consistent voters. I'd like to know, why don't the older Americans simply say, this is what we want, this is what we're going to vote for, and refuse to support candidates who won't do it?
Marilyn.
Well, I actually just wanted to point out that we do think of long-term care as something that is needed for older people. And that's why a lot of younger people don't want to buy it. They don't want to pay premiums for something they think, I'm 30 years old, I'm not going to have Alzheimer's, or until I'm 70, maybe I won't have it at all. But the truth is that long-term care is also needed for many younger people. We're talking about people who have spinal cord injuries. We're talking about children who have autism, are in need of long-term care services. We're not just talking about nursing home care. We're talking about getting people home care and help in the home. If you can't perform some acts of daily living, whether it's because you have Alzheimer's and you're older or you're younger, then it's really the same thing.
Marilyn Werber, Serafini, she's with National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Ellen, who's in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I assumed you said Ellen.
Yes, I did.
I got static.
Go ahead.
I just had the thought that if someone signs up for Medicare and they make, and this relates to the long-term care, and they make over $100,000, maybe they have to sign up for that program.
James Furman.
Well, we believe the program should be voluntary for people and even for employers to sponsor it. But we also believe that many people are going to see the wisdom and the value of this program. Because Sandy Prager said something earlier about private insurance. Well, let's make a distinction. Private companies, when they apply, they plan to only pay back 60 to 65 cents on the dollar. The rest is for profit, marketing, sales, and overhead. They often pay 70 or 80% commission the first year. The government plan is going to pay back 97 cents on the dollar, so 50% more efficient. It will also create a market, just like Medicare created Medigap. A class act will create a wraparound market as well.
And Marilyn, from the perspective you have as a journalist, how much of an opportunity do you think this bill has to move forward with this long-term health care plan involved?
Right. Well, it looks as though they got past the major hurdle, the first major hurdle, which was the question of whether the money could be spent for other purposes. But still, we have, like I said, we have a number of people, a number of Democrats who voted against this bill. In the end, it looks to me that many of these people will see it as better than nothing. This is an issue that has been hanging over Congress's head, a big dark cloud, for many, many years. Members of Congress have been scared to touch this issue because it is so expensive. Mm. For a day of nursing home care, we're talking about a cost of over $200. That's expensive. And Medicaid has been paying most of this. It's an enormously expensive issue.
Scott Harrington, what's your projection?
My projection would be that there is a good chance this will be taken out of a bill that the Senate would pass. I know that's not much of a projection, but I think the concern about what might happen in the out years, even though it would ostensibly be self-sustaining, may make people think that it's a little too much to bite off at this point.
And James Furtman.
This is the best and last hope for the baby boom generation and all Americans to get the kind of long-term care program we need to keep us at home. It's going to come down to one issue on the senators. Whose side are you on? Are you on the side of big insurance? Are you on the side of seniors, people with disabilities, and their families who desperately want to pay for themselves in a fiscally sound program for the long-term care they need?
James Furtman, he's president and CEO of the National Council on Aging. Marilyn Werber, Sarah Feeney, she's with the National Journal. Scott Harrington is professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And Sandy Prager is insurance commissioner for the state of Kansas. Thank you all so much, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.